Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on commonwealthclub.org on Facebook and Twitter and on our YouTube channel. I'm Michael Finney. I head up the 7 on Your Side consumer unit for ABC 7 and host Consumer Talk on KGO Radio, both here in San Francisco. I'll be your moderator for today's program. Our guest is Paul Solman. He's been a business and economics correspondent offering sensible financial guidance for the legendary PBS NewsHour program since 1985. His new book, Get What's Yours, The Secret to Maxing Out Your Social Security, gives readers tools to navigate the complex Social Security system in order to maximize the benefits that you are eligible to receive. Having over three decades of experience as a journalist and professor, Paul understands better than most how our economy works and the many ways it actually impacts our daily lives. He covers topics as far-ranging as municipal bond rates and where money or whether money can actually buy happiness. We'll have to talk about that. And he does it with a voice and style that makes it complicated, approachable, and even entertaining constantly. Paul has won 2 Peabody Awards and 8 Emmys for his work in broadcasting. He's a graduate of Brandeis University and Harvard Business School. At Yale, he co-teaches the Studies and Grand Strategy Seminar, adding a dose of economics to the program. Paul is an institution in the world of journalism and economic dialogue, and we're excited for him to share his wisdom with us today, especially today, because this is the 80th anniversary of Social Security. Please welcome Paul Solman to San Francisco.
Thank you. An institution? Holy Jesus. This is the first time you'll have ever been addressed by an institution, I expect. Look, I'm going to read my remarks. They told me I had 20 minutes, and once I start talking, I ramble, and it'll take forever. So bear with me. I'll try to make as much contact as I can. This is just a speech written just for you guys, so this is not like something that I have potted and ready. And I also want to get to the Q&A. As quickly as we can, and talking to Michael, who we've already been having a good time back in the... Is that a green room? Was that a green room?
Yes.
Okay, the green room. Okay, let's get to the meat of the book, and let's get that out of the way before I try in the final few minutes before the Q&A to provoke you. We have 3 basic rules that you need to know, which Get What's Yours then elaborates and repeats, some would say ad nauseum. They are, 1, be patient, 2, be aware of and know how to get all the benefits to which you're entitled. There are 10 different ones, last I counted. 3, since you can't take more than one benefit at a time, stagger your benefits to get all of what's yours. Let me repeat and elaborate very briefly. First, be patient. The most important insight of the book, which co-author Larry Kotlikoff taught me as we began writing Get What's Yours, is that for almost anyone who can afford it, the best bet is to wait until age 70 to start collecting Social Security. There are exceptions for some people with dependents eligible for benefits on the primary beneficiary's record, but for almost everyone, we urge you to wait. Why? Because for each year that you wait, your subsequent lifetime benefit goes up, inflation adjusted. That is your check, the check you get. And the rate at which it goes up is nothing to sneeze at in the era of zero bank account interest. Roughly 8% for every year you wait between age 62 and 70. Now, I did already know this when Larry first annoyed me with a Social Security question 5 years ago during a game of what we laughably call tennis. In fact, when he asked what I was doing about Social Security, I proudly announced that my wife and I were waiting until 70. We'd not taken any early benefits before our full retirement age of 66 because, well, frankly, they had the word early attached, and early seemed like it couldn't be a good idea. But we were waiting until 70 for a better reason. Proudly, I'd done a break-even analysis. As a result, I concluded that by the time I reached 83 or so, my greater annual benefits, starting at age 70, would have equaled the money I'd have left on the table by not taking benefits from age 66 to 70, those 4 years. And after 83, age 83, I'd be ahead of the game. And since my mom lived to 90, my dad to 99, I figured the odds of getting to 83 were substantial enough to make waiting the savvy choice. But no, said Larry. That's a dumb way to think about it. Social Security, this is crucial. I'd say this is the most important single thing that the book has to offer, really. We make the argument in somewhat more detail than I'm going to make it here. But Social Security is insurance, insurance against catastrophe. And that's what Larry insisted on, and believe me, nobody can insist like Larry Kotlikoff. The catastrophe that my wife and I would outlive our savings and wind up dependent on our children or on our friends or on the state or on caretakers at some ninth-rate nursing home. You don't do a break-even analysis when you're buying fire insurance on your home or a liability insurance on your car, Larry pointed out, somewhat condescendingly. You're not hoping to get more than the insurance premium you pay, right? Break even, you know, you get back the money. So why would you think that way about old age insurance? I believe now, though I'm reluctant to say it, even though he isn't here to gloat, that Larry was incontrovertibly correct. Again, a warning, this is only if you can afford to wait and if certain conditions regarding dependents don't obtain. But patience is a punchline we drum home to skeptics with bad reasons not to wait. And there are plenty of people with bad reasons. For example, some optimists think that they will beat Social Security by taking their benefit money early and investing it more profitably than the rate of return they get from Social Security. But then most Americans, I would remind you, live in Lake Wobegon. In a survey of faculty at the University of Nebraska, two-thirds rated themselves in the top 25% for teaching ability. Nearly 90% of MBA students at Stanford rated their academic performance in the top half of the class. Back in 1976, 70% of students taking the annual SAT test thought they were in the top half of their peers with respect to leadership ability, getting along with others. A full 85%. Put themselves above the medium, and we love this, 25% rated themselves in the top 1%. This is known, by the way, as illusory superiority. I mean, that's literally the technical term. And while illusory superiority is a worldwide phenomenon, it's especially acute for those of you contemplating the investment of Social Security money. Americans, that is. A famous study of drivers half a century ago found, for example, that 67% of Swedes considered themselves above average in driving skill. Americans, 93%. So I swear to God. Safe driving, 77% of Swedes, 88% of Americans above average. 25 years later, American self-delusion had hardly budged. Asked to rate themselves by 8 different measures, including skill and safety, only 1 driver in 5 thought him or herself below average. Simple fact is, on a risk-adjusted basis, Social Security's guaranteed inflation-adjusted return is better than any available alternative by a lot. And risk-adjusted is the only sound way to compare investments, as anyone holding a Greek bond right now paying 10% or more can attest, okay? There's one more reason people take their benefits too soon. They think Social Security is going broke, in part because of people like Larry, actually, who keep insisting that it is, and that they'd be better off by taking whatever they can as soon as they can. But folks, ask yourself this. If the U.S. government, and this would be more for young people in the audience, of which there are a precious few, but that's okay, because I'm older than probably most of you. If the U.S. government were to renege on its Social Security promises, what would happen? An impeachment epidemic? Mass revolt? Yes, someday taxes will have to be raised, benefits perhaps trimmed, means tested, which would certainly be reasonable, but not anytime soon, and not for anyone deciding now or in the near future whether or not to take benefits before age 70. On this, Larry, co-author Phil Moeller, and I all agree. By the way, show of hands, how many of you think that about 20% of Americans or more wait until 70? 20% or more. How many people think that that's the case? Only a few of you think that. 10% or more. 10% of Americans. Well, about a third of the people here. 5%. At least 5%. Now we're more than half. 3%. No, 3% or more. 3% of Americans or more. No, it can't be less than 5%, folks. We're going down, so this is a larger and larger number. Can we get, so how many people think at least 3% of Americans take their Social Security by 70 or more? Okay, so the answer is less than 2%. And even though Get What's Yours, right here, you can get it over there, is an official bestseller, has been on the Times top 10 list ever since it came out half a year ago, save for the first month when Amazon was out of stock. It's only sold around 175,000 copies so far, which means that barely 0.2% of America's 77 million or so baby boomers have a copy. And maybe, I don't know, maybe the numbers have turned around dramatically on waiting till 70, but I sincerely doubt it. Okay, on to rule number two, get all of what's yours. As I said, there are nearly a dozen different benefits for dependent children, dependent parents, widows, widowers, the disabled, just to name a few. So I can't very well discuss them all here, but the one that applies to most people, and of which so many people are unaware, including me when I began this project, and perhaps many of you, is the spousal benefit. For those currently married and anyone who was divorced but was married for at least 10 years. It was Larry's telling me about spousal benefits at that same so-called tennis outing that prompted me to invite him to write a weekly Ask Larry column for our PBS Making Sense Economics website, and then that inspired years later this book. You see, after boasting that my wife and I had figured out Social Security, we were waiting till 70 and so forth, Larry asked if I were taking spousal benefits. No, I scoffed. We're not entitled to any such thing. Truth is, I'd never heard of them. How old are you, Larry asked. I was about to turn 66, my wife 67. I'm going to make you $50,000 in the next minute and a half, he said. And then you take me to dinner. And he did. And I did. Because what we did was, when my wife, I think she'd already turned 66, all she did is she called Social Security and she said, hey, listen, I want to apply for Social Security, but suspend the payment. I want to be in the system, but suspend. Now she's in the system. She's a year older than me. Now I turn 66. I call up Social Security. They couldn't have been nicer, very punctual and so forth. I said, I want to take my spousal benefit. They said, and the woman on the phone, this was in Boston, said, I don't think you can do that, sir. I said, oh, yes, I can. I have the world's foremost authority as my friend here. She went, she talked to the supervisor, came back. She said, sir, yes, you can, and thank you so much, because I will now tell everybody else whom I talk to that this is something that can be done. So that's how it works. All you have to have is one spouse who's in the system but can be waiting until 70 and not collecting. But if she were collecting, it would be the same thing. I still, when I turn 66, could take the spousal benefit until I turn 70 and then take my benefit, which had been accruing the whole time. Everybody follow? Okay, because that, yes, everybody, any question here? Because this is sort of, do you get it? Don't get it. All right, let me do it one more time, just because this is, maybe I'll cut the speech short, because this is the key, probably the most useful insight to most people. Again, it's divorced as well as married. Yeah, well, just ask the question and then.
Can we do it simultaneously?
Yeah, if you're divorced, you can do it simultaneously. It would have paid for me and my wife to get divorced. That would have been the real gaming of the system. But no. No, only one member of the couple can be taking a spousal benefit at any given time. Follow? So that's how it works. Okay, everybody gets that now. And I was just going to make, so, and I said here, I wrote, in fact, it would have been true even if we'd been married for 10 years and divorced. That's just to make things more exciting. Indeed, had my wife been married for the first time at age 18 for a decade, given up on that loser and found another at 28, whom she endured for another 10 years, took a third husband for another decade at 38, switched yet again at 48, and then married me at 58, all five of us could collect spousal benefits on her work record, so long as each of us wasn't taking his own benefits. And had she and I divorced at age 68, the point I was just making, both of us could have collected on each other until we turned 70. In fact, the optimal strategy would have been for us to divorce at 66, and at which point, of course, we could have renewed our vows, right? Would have been very touching. Anyway, that we felt would have been truly gaming the system. But the regular spousal benefit is something to which all of us are entitled, have paid into the system to provide for. In fact, and I researched this, feeling a little guilty that I was getting what's mine but needed it a lot less than others, it turns out that my wife and I, having both worked all our lives and contributed so much to Social Security, in my case probably the maximum and hers not far from it, are actually slightly net losers with regard to spousal benefits. The winners are couples with great disparities in earnings, where one or the other member of the couple earned nothing at all but now gets the spousal benefits. The real losers are those who never married for 10 years or more, particularly single people, obviously. Though the system as a whole remains progressive, I should point out, in that people with lower lifetime earnings get a higher percentage of their earnings and benefits than those who earned more. Okay, finally, I'm going to actually end with just the book part of this, because otherwise I'll go on to my provocative comments about complexity, but that'll take another 20 minutes because I'm not reading fast enough. Okay, finally, rule three, time your benefits. That's what I did with my spousal benefit. That's what many of you may be able to do depending on your circumstances. Too many complications to lay them all out here. And besides, Larry is the guy to do it, not the economics popularizer or institution, I know, which is my role at the PBS NewsHour all these years. I'll just do a little bit of the provocation. The word complications is what prompts it in the final remarks, and the ones designed not to assist but to provoke. And if Larry were here, by God, would this provoke him? Then let me just rather than do this from the script, because I'll finish. How long have I been talking? Almost 20 minutes. All right. So let me just very briefly, one of the things that keeps getting talked about with regard to this book in particular, the columnist, personal investment columnist for the New York Times, Ron Lieber, made a big deal out of this. This book's success is symptomatic of something that we take for granted but should actually disgust us. The complexity of our financial lives is so extreme that we must painstakingly manage each and every aspect of it, from government programs to investing to loyalty programs. So all this complexity, what a terrible thing, and Larry goes on and on. He has some plan, he calls it the purple plan, which is he's figured out how to make it all simple and everything will be easy and we won't have to go through this, and there are 2,728 rules and you won't need a book like this, et cetera, et cetera. And I just think that's all nonsense, okay? Just without elaborating by reading you another, I don't know how many pages here, I think that it is fair to say that America's greatest strength is our complexity. And that all this business about we're an overly litigious society and so forth, I've thought a lot about this, and I used to believe that too. I don't believe that anymore either. I think we're litigious because we're a rights-based, pluralistic, mature economy where people really care about the nuances, and the nuances are complex, and the nuances take all kinds of rules in order to understand them, to work them through, to argue with each other about them, and so forth. So I think complexity is America's greatest strength, because the complexity comes from the fact that we have the rule of law and the sanctity of contracts here, and that's why people all over the world want to come to this place, okay? Because we've got something, and we secure rights in ways that nobody else does. I'll read you one bit from the book to finally make my point, and then I'll sit down. Here's why Social Security is so complex. There's 2,728 rules. We had a technical expert named Jerry Lutz. He reviewed our whole book. He went over it. He was a technical expert for Social Security as his lifelong job for 30-some-odd years. So he told us this story, and we put it in the book right at the end before it went to press. One day, while Jerry still worked for Social Security, a claims representative approached him with a question, just like the woman I was talking to must have approached somebody like him. A new claimant's husband had died of a heart attack while they were having sex. They had been married for less than 9 months, the threshold for receiving survivor benefits from Social Security. But one of the exceptions to the 9-month duration of marriage rule involves accidental death. Up until then, Jerry had considered accidental to mean something like a car wreck. But his job was to research tough cases like this one. So he searched the vast Social Security rulebook and found POMSGN, but I won't give you all the numbers, which describes an accidental death in part as follows. A bodily injury occurs whenever the outside force or cause affects the body sufficiently to interfere with its normal function. The cause of the bodily injury is external, in quotes, if it originated outside the body. An external force can include an injury suffered due to weather conditions or exertion. Note, this is all from the POMS. This is the Program of Operating Management System or something. Note, by exertion, we mean an activity that involves at least moderate effort for the average person. Routine activities, e.g. standing, do not constitute exertion for purposes of finding accidental death. Circumstances which more readily lend themselves to a favorable ruling of accidental death include an unexpected heart attack occurs during moderate exertion. An unforeseen event negates the voluntary nature of an activity, e.g. an exercise machine breaks down while exercising. Some unintended, unexpected, and unforeseen result occurs during exertion, e.g. a fall or slip while running, they didn't think of everything, or a crisis or sudden peril requires strenuous exertion. So Jerry thought moderate exertion, arguably, unintended and unexpected, indubitably. And so based on the claimant's testimony and her husband's death certificate, widow's benefits were eventually conferred. But the point is, and I'll end with this, the point is, it was anything but simple. It's incredibly complex. And I think you could say that's what's great about America, because we bother to make these kinds of distinctions so that we can be as fair as we possibly can. Thank you very much.
Well, Paul, you said this book started on a tennis court.
Yes.
And it is such a great book, it took three people to write it.
Well, I thought...
Why is that?
It took two people to write it and one person to make sure that we wrote it. I think that's fair, although... Why is it? Why did it take three people?
You have all three voices in the book. It's fascinating.
Yeah, well, no, because Larry... I mean, all of these answers will be honest answers. The answer is, and I would say it if Larry were here, and in fact, if some of you ask me questions that I don't know the answer to, that's why I brought back my cell phone so I can call Larry and get you the right answer as opposed to making something up. Because Larry is an economist, and although he's written popular books, they haven't been that popular. and he's not somebody whose job it is to popularize, you know, complicated things. And so his simple version of the complicated is still pretty damn complicated. And so my job was to make it less complicated and to make it somewhat amusing and to tell a story, and those are things I know how to do. So that's why it took two people. And then the third person, I think Larry brought in presciently, thinking that the two of us, Larry and I, are so busy teaching, lecturing, that there was a fair shot that we wouldn't get it done in a timely way without somebody else cracking the whip, reading, and vetting Larry, because Larry also shoots from the hip, and this guy's a really great reporter, a personal finance reporter, Phil Moeller. And so he was brought on, and so that's why there were three of us.
You addressed it up there, but I want to talk about it again, because you hear this constantly. Is the book cheating? Is it about how to cheat?
Yeah, no, it's That's a particularly pointed, pertinent question, because there's, I was telling you in the green room about a bulk sale that the publisher has done, and the people who bought it are really sort of reselling the book cheaper, and it's it, the ad copy is almost something like, be the first cheat on your block or something. Like that. I mean, some, you know, the loophole is the word they use, is loophole. You don't know about this loophole. No, it's not cheating. It's what the law says you can do. And you, anybody here is welcome to, one, take their benefits and give them away to somebody who's poorer, or just send a check to the government. I mean, you know, and why not? What about the mortgage interest deduction? Well, there's a phony if ever I heard one. I mean, you know, the mortgage interest deduction, and you depreciate your house, you depreciate it, and it's growing in value. Well, that's cheating. So I think we should all send a check to the government for the difference between the actual appreciation of the house and the depreciation. So, no, you do, you follow the rules. The rules may, it may be that the rules here with regard to spousal benefits are unfair. It's a little tricky to know, because if you ended spousal benefits, what about people who are who were working? What about a woman who was working in the home, never was paid, right, for the work she did, and then she's not entitled to some recognition of that? She didn't pay into the system, so she is a net beneficiary. But do we really want to end spousal benefits so there's no advantage, for example, to ever having been married, and so forth and so on? Me personally, I think the ceiling on Social Security income, after which you don't pay taxes, which is $118,500, I think, at the moment, something like that, a little over $118,000. After that, you don't pay a dime. You know, we are all are paying 6.4%, and our employers are paying 6.4%, or if we're self-employed, we're paying 12.8% right. of our income flat on Social Security, but only up to 118.5. That number does move up every year, but it doesn't move up anywhere near as fast as the inequality in income in the United States, right? So that in about 20 years ago or so, that ceiling, lower at the time because, you know, it's been adjusted for inflation, but that ceiling covered about 90% of all American income. Now it covers close to 80%. If you just raise that ceiling, this is Social Security's own numbers, if you just raise that ceiling back to 90%, a third of the entire Social Security shortfall forever would be eliminated just by that alone. So I would say cheating? No. Getting what's yours, I'd say once you do the thing with the 10 different, where you get, if Jan and I had gotten divorced and then gotten back together, I would have thought that was sleazy. I don't know about cheating, but I would have thought sleazy. But no, I don't think that, but I do think there's changes should be made in Social Security to make it even more progressive than it is.
Once you talk about means testing, aren't you really talking about shifting Social Security into being a welfare program?
Well, I suppose if every, you know, if I got nothing and welfare, let me try to think. I don't want to be glib in answering that question. At some extreme, sure, you know, that's where I was trying to go. So everybody who makes more than $50,000 a year gets nothing, and all the Social Security money goes to people who make less than 30. Right. Yeah, that would be a welfare program or a giveaway or something like that. It's all, I mean, it's like with any public policy. You know, you're always trying to titrate it. You're always trying to come to some kind of balance as to what's fair and what's not fair. The argument against raising the ceiling on Social Security income has always been, from people on the left as well as on the right, mainly from people on the left, in fact, in this case, is you want to keep everybody in the game so that they don't say things like what you just said. You want to make sure there's a broad enough constituency for Social Security that it doesn't get thrown away and everybody's on their own resources and then there's no guarantee.
You say it's not a retirement, it's insurance.
Uh-huh.
Are the vast majority of financial planners wrong? They would tell you.
Oh, yes. Oh, they're wrong because because unless they're working on a fee basis, their incentives are completely warped. I mean, you know, if you just think about, you know, how most of financial planners are paid, or many financial planners are paid, they're paid as a commission of the assets under management. You know, so, and then they have relationships with the people who do the yes, you're nodding your head. You know what I'm going to say before I say it. So yes, I think most financial planners are suspect, and you need to be very, very careful about who you get. One thing that financial planners, for example, never tell you to do is buy bonds, inflation-protected bonds. I know we're wandering off here a little bit, but you got me started.
Tips,
right. Treasury inflation-protected securities. I'm not saying they're the greatest thing in the world or anything, but no, you find me a financial planner who ever told one of their clients to buy tips. And the reason is because there's no percentage on it. That you get very little interest, but it's absolutely completely protected. And you can buy it direct from online from the government, and so the financial planner is out of the picture, right?
Right.
So in this case, yes, it is, to get back to the main point, it is really surprising the extent to which financial planners don't know about Social Security and any of the things we're talking about here. That's anecdotal. I have not done a rigorous survey of this, but from everything I have heard, that seems to be the case.
I have many questions here from the audience. Let's begin with this. Are you concerned about Social Security's longevity?
Yeah, I don't. How could you not be? It's the most important retirement program that the United States has for its citizens. It is not going broke. It is underfunded. It is underfunded, meaning that the promises that we've made to the future, the way we account for them is less than the amount that we're promising. It's not, there never was a lockbox. There never was some stash of money somewhere that people were going to start taking out and paying once the baby boomers retired. It's not how it works. The money comes in, and then the government has a question. What do you invest the money in? So the government could take a flyer on Portugal bonds right now. I think they're... I'd short them if I were the government. But, you know, the government could start, you know, deciding, oh, I think Google looks good, you know, and could do that. What the government decided was, what's the safest investment in the world? U.S. bonds. So the government then buys the U.S. bonds with the money that comes in from Social Security. If we were not running deficits, then we would not have unfunded liabilities, that is, promises we haven't yet paid for. But we decided, and maybe Social Security's money going back to the bonds helped us decide, that we didn't have to worry about that. So someday we'll pay the piper in terms of higher, as I said, in terms of higher taxes. There'll be modifications to the benefits, I hope, for people who are particularly well-heeled, or I don't know that that's going to be the case, because those people have disproportionate political power, as I think we all know. And at the worst, the benefits will be somewhat lower, you know, 40 years down the line or something like that. Or we just keep kicking the can down the line forever. I mean, the United States hasn't paid off its national debt since, I don't know, Andrew Jackson, I think, or something. I'm not even joking. I mean, I think that's the last time it was, because he was a lunatic about debt. But, you know, and the British debt has never been paid off. And people used to think, Adam Smith in 1776 wrote about how the British national debt was going to come due, and it was going to be, there was hell to pay, he and David Hume. Didn't happen. So anyway.
So Social Security, we're often told, is broke. There's no money there. It's really sitting in government bonds, similar to the U.S. government bonds that China owns.
Mm-hmm.
But no one says China doesn't own those bonds. Am I right? So what we're talking about is politics?
Yeah. Yeah. And what I'm saying, and what I said before, is Who do you think the United States is going to renege on its obligations to first? Us or China? I mean, seriously, what fantasy is there that you're going to go to the Social Security office and go, oh, I'm sorry, we ran out of, we just don't have it. We got to, you know, we're going to have to borrow more money. I don't think so. We'll, no, I mean, it's ridiculous. You know what the U.S. bond, you know what U.S. bonds paying in interest now, what people here must know, you know, 10 years, you lend money to the U.S. government for 10 years, you get a bond, that is, you get the IOU, right? 10 years, it's like 2.1%. And then you get your money back after 10 years. 2.1%. That includes the risk of inflation. That includes the risk that they won't pay you back, you know, because there's some, because Congress won't raise the debt ceiling or some insanity like that. All of that, and it's the value of money, the time value of money. I mean, if I give you money, right, you're paying me for it because you get to use the money and I don't. So that money's worth something, the fact that you have it as opposed to me. Plus the inflation risk, plus the default risk, and we're at 2.1%. I mean, how dangerous is the U.S. bond? It's, you know, when the world gets into tough shape, look at what's happening in China right now. Everybody runs to the U.S. dollar and to U.S. bonds because it's the safest thing out there. It's why Social Security's money is in U.S. bonds, and I don't know what else would be safer than that. So.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. We're talking with Paul Solomon, business and economics correspondent, PBS NewsHour, and co-author of Get What's Yours, The Secret to Maxing Out Your Social Security. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. I'm Michael Finney, your moderator. Another question from the audience. You mentioned waiting until 70, not 7. That would be a real economic.
Well, you want to wait at least until 7. Then I'd wait 63 more years.
What about
waiting? By the way, but just one quick, quickly. Do not wait a day after 70.
That's the question. Why not wait until after 70?
This is my Johnny Carson great Kreskin for routine work. The answer is, no, I didn't figure you were lying.
No, you can hold it up.
oh, I see. All right. The answer is, do not wait till after 70. Although somebody just said that, so. No, don't wait for a day after 70. Although here's a key thing to keep in mind for those of you who don't know it. You can keep working till you keel over. And still, not only you can be taking your Social Security, but if you're working at a higher income than you did in the past, your Social Security paycheck will go up. So just briefly, the way Social Security calculates your benefit is on the basis of the top 35 years worth of earnings, okay? So obviously, if one of those years you were, like I was, a cab driver, where I didn't even declare all my tips, that was cheating. but I was young. And the other cab driver...
Youthful indiscretion.
You know, the other cab drivers declared less. That's all I can say. I said, well, I got to declare something. No, you don't declare anything. Anyway, for that year... Right, if that was one of my 35 years, and now I worked in year 36 at my current, you know, teaching plus PBS NewsHour and so forth, my 36th year would kick out that year, the lousy cab driving year, and my total the formula would have my total benefit going up. They actually take your previous benefits. This is more than even I want to know. So, but just to finish the thought, the way they do it is they inflation adjust my cab driving year, for example. They inflation adjust previous years, but only up until age 60. Do not ask me why. I'm sure there was some good reason at the time. So that means for every year after 60, you're no longer getting that inflation bump. So adjustment. so that as inflation happens, and if inflation were to run away and suddenly a standard salary would be $200,000 because the dollar would be worth so little, why, that would go into your Social Security formula and you would be benefiting thereby. So it can pay, often does pay, if you're doing reasonably well, to work on and on, but at the very least, it does not in any way jeopardize your taking Social Security.
Why is it better to take spousal benefits if you don't need the money?
Better? Better than what? Than not taking?
Better than not taking.
I think that's an early economic principle. More money is better than less money. It might not be morally better if that bothers you. You don't have to take it.
I think they may be concerned that somehow it's subtracted from your money later.
No. I'm sorry. Thank you. I just didn't understand the question. No. It doesn't have any implication at all on what your spouse gets. It's just a benefit. Came in 1939. It came in. It's really interesting. It came in because of the recession of 1937 and 38. So for those of you who remember your New Deal history, in the 1930s, we hit rock bottom, and when Roosevelt comes in March of 33, and I mean rock bottom, right? The stock market was down by 90%, inflation up from 2.9% to 25%, as best they measured it in those days. Industrial production down 40%. That's what happened between October 29 and March of 33. So you're at a complete low ebb, and now Roosevelt starts doing everything, you know, crazy stuff like the National Recovery Act, fixing prices and stuff. But he puts people back to work, including my dad, as an artist in the Works Progress Administration. And the economy comes back up. Stock market goes back up from 40 to over 100. Started at 380. I mean, at its peak, it was at 380. So things are going well and so forth. But Roosevelt runs on a balanced budget in 36. And then we have the recession of 37, 38. Or at least this is one version of the story of what happened. Okay, people will contest this. But this is the story I subscribe to. 37, 38, we now have a contraction again. It was called the mini depression, and there's a contraction, and then there was the pressure was on to stimulate the economy, and one way to stimulate the economy absolutely explicitly was to move up Social Security benefits that were only going to be coming in 1942. They moved up to 1940, and to give more benefits, and one of the benefits given was to spouses. And that's where the spousal benefit came from. So if you think that the country doesn't need a Keynesian infusion and therefore feel guilty about taking the spousal benefit, don't take it. It's perfectly okay. But it doesn't affect any other benefit that you're taking. You're entitled to it, and if you're a two-income earner, you're being arguably a chump for not taking it because you are paying for it in any case.
One of the most interesting things I read in your book, Tips and Tricks, was you can get an interest-free loan from Social Security, right?
Yeah, that one, that's too complicated for me. Yes, you can. How do you do that? I can't remember. I don't know. Read the book. Well, tell me.
But basically,
So you tell them.
You take the money. You can take the money earlier than 70. You can hang on to the money. You can just keep getting it. And then let's say you take it at 66, if that's your full retirement age. And then as you're coming up on 70, you still have this pile of money. You can give it all back and restart your payment at a higher level.
Yeah, you could. That's where you suspend. You suspend in between, right? That's a start-stop-start strategy.
Right.
Yes, you can do that, but read the book and you'll
see. I learned it from his book.
Yeah. Larry wrote that part.
Do domestic partners have the same Social Security benefits and options as married couples?
No, you have to be married. That's why gay marriage is so important in terms of Social Security. Domestic partnership, no, it is specific. And for those, there are no states anymore. When we wrote this, we were tracking the how many states allowed for gay marriage or same-sex marriage because there are a whole set of rules that Social Security has as to, you know, I got married to my spouse in Texas, which didn't recognize same-sex marriage, and then we moved to Massachusetts, or I moved, but my husband didn't. What happens? And there were differences in each case. It was very elaborate, and we go into that in the book. Now, that chapter is fundamentally irrelevant, but it is the difference between being married or not married, that's for sure. It's not just domestic partnership, man.
I'm trying to find...
You're trying to find one you wrote or something?
I'm trying to find one I can read. Handwriting, people.
This is a post-handwriting age.
Yeah, it is.
I can vamp one.
I have so... No. The question here, and I've seen it a couple of times here, is do you both need to be age 66 and above in order to take the spousal benefit?
No. Yeah. It's just that it's in part of the be patient. You want to wait until that's when your spousal benefit doesn't go up after age 66. That's the key. So that's why 66 is a crucial date for taking a spousal benefit. That's when you get the maximum at 66. So 70 for your own benefit, but 66 for a spousal benefit. Everybody follow? Yeah, okay, good.
It's 66 if that's your maximum at this time, right? Because that's, not maximum, the full benefit.
Yeah, because that's right. Because the spousal benefit is based on what's called the FRA, which is the full retirement age. And full retirement age at the moment is 66, going up to 67 because of the reforms of 1983 under Alan Greenspan for anybody born after after the year 1960. But the point is the spousal benefit is 50% of your spouse's full retirement age benefit, and that's locked in. Therefore, it doesn't make sense to wait after age 66.
You can only take one benefit at a time,
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's correct. You personally, other members of the family, obviously.
Right. Then is there any way to mess up so you couldn't end up with your full benefit at the end of this?
No, I don't think, I don't know the answer to that question, but I don't think there's a way unless you yourself took your own benefit early. Oh, wait, there is a way to do that. It's very complicated. I'm wrong. You can, if you take a spousal benefit early, then I believe you are deemed, that's the word they use, deemed to have been taking your full benefit. It's very complicated because of, but yes, maybe. Look it up. It's not a clean slate. Look, this stuff is incredibly complicated to get right, even though I argue in favor of complexity and think it's a great strength of America. You know, Larry has there's a Maximize My Social Security software that Larry has. He sells for about $40. I have no piece of it. There are other Social Security software. I think Larry's is generally considered to be the best. I've been rated as such and so forth. And so all these kinds of very specific nuances will come out in the wash when you put your numbers in.
So you have to be very careful with this.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. Look, that's why we wrote the book. To give you some general guidelines and then say, be aware of what's going on and then research it. This isn't the only Social Security book out there. There have been any number of others. There are columnists who write about this. Larry's been writing about it for 3 years on my, PBS right. NewsHour webpage. It's not simple. You want to know what the optimal strategy is. That may take some significant research, but at least be aware that these things are available and complicated, and you ought to know what you're doing. Look, I speak only from personal experience. I'm obviously a sophisticated guy. I know a lot about economics. I match myself against almost anybody on that score. Had no idea, that there was a thing called spousal benefits. Just didn't know. Never had bothered. Nobody had ever told me. I don't read Social Security columns. If it hadn't been for Larry, I'm sure I wouldn't have taken him. I can tell you, I was going to say I can't tell you, but I can tell you the number of people whom, when I've told them this, friends say, oh my God, I had no idea, and go right to the phone to get their spousal benefit. I had one guy, he's a tenured, well-known, tenured, chaired professor of economics at Harvard. The guy was astounded. We were having lunch. He said, what are you doing? I said, oh, by the way, one of the things I'm doing is Social Security book. I said, by the way, Ben, did you know that? What? Oh, my wife just turned 67. She missed a year. But a college roommate of mine, the guy was the co-editor of my paper in college. Same thing.
You're talking now about those that are educated in financial affairs not knowing about all of this. You right. talked about when you telephoned that yes. Social Security didn't know about
yep,
it.
Yep, yep.
And that brings me to this question. What's the best way to deal with Social Security representatives who do not understand the rules?
You have to read the book, and you read the book aloud to them. And then, as has happened on a number of occasions, more than a few, you call Larry, and you have Larry write to them. He's such a fanatic that he actually calls up the Social Security people and so forth. But you cite the book. You go to the Social Security website. I mean, nobody wants to become this much of an expert, I don't think. But if you've got a little extra time on your hands, what the hell? Maybe you can write the next edition of the book. and you research it, and you send them, and you say, hey, look, here's what it says. It's all there. Just, unfortunately, it's 2,728 rules and pages and pages to explicate the rules. But it's not like they're trying to hide it from you. And it's not like they're nefarious. I mean, the one thing that when Larry and I do this together, we get into spats about this because he's got some nonsense about how it was all designed to be too complicated and bureaucrats were perniciously, you know, creating the law and, you know, the people in Social Security don't know and they've been kept in the dark. No, it's like anything else that's complicated. I mean, these people are completely overworked. They're understaffed. This was in the remarks I was going to make. They're understaffed like almost every government agency. I know they're also protected by civil service, and there are a lot of them are just lazy bureaucrats because a lot of us are lazy, you know, and when our jobs are protected, maybe we're encouraged to be even more lazy or less, you know, vital or whatever the right word is. But they're dealing with like millions of people, and you can imagine now with the baby boom coming online, 10,000 Americans turning 66 every day. Every day. So, you know, all these people calling up, they haven't read the book. As I say, it's 0.2% of baby boomers who have, you know, by the numbers, who have even bought the book, assuming it was all baby boomers, you know. So most people have no idea. They call Social Security. Social Security is overwhelmed. And you're going to run into people who, like everywhere else in life, have no idea what they're talking about. I mean, you know, they know some stuff, and they don't know the nuances. Look, I'm sitting up here, and you ask me a question. I go, I don't remember. And I wrote a whole book about the damn thing. You know, so what do you expect from somebody in Social Security handling 9 calls? Hey, are you getting coffee today? You know, yeah, I'll get out there in a minute. I think it's wrong to be particularly censorious, but it is absolutely necessary to be careful and to pursue it and to not, once they say, no, that's wrong, say, I want to talk to a supervisor. Let's look at the PMOMS together. They're not out there to screw you, that's for sure. But they are overwhelmed, and many of them don't know the rules.
This question is referring to waiting until 70 before you take Social Security. They say one risk of waiting is politicians changing the program in the future,
yeah.
i.e. not paying the benefit if you have too high of income or net worth. Would you But what's your take on that?
Well, I've said one thing, I think, which is that the ceiling should go back up. That would affect people with higher incomes. Right now, the maximum you pay in taxes on Social Security is 85%. So that could go to 100%, for example. Right. I can see both sides of the argument. One is, hey, wait a second, I already paid taxes on that money. The other one is, it's income. And why shouldn't it be taxed? And why shouldn't people who have more be taxed more? That's what progressive taxation is. And that's, we believe in progressive taxation, although you started the questions with, is it welfare, you know?
Right.
So at some point, there, you know, and you strike a balance and you figure out what works and what doesn't. I'm just back literally yesterday from Singapore, where I was teaching a seminar at a new liberal arts college that Yale and the National University of Singapore have combined to create, brand new. I mean, it's in its third year. And we did a seminar on income inequality. Four classes, 3 hours each. Really, really fascinating. And I would urge anybody who has the chance to go to Singapore to do it. It's one of the most amazing stories on earth, coming from complete poverty in 50 years to $55,000 per capita income there.
Wow.
And the head of the National University of Singapore said 50 years ago he was sleeping on the floor, he didn't have a bed, and his wife was in a village, and they didn't have any sanitation, so the night soil truck would come and pick up all the human feces to use as fertilizer. I mean, that's in 50 years, okay? But the point of the inequality, the sort of the punchline, or where we got to at the end of this seminar with regard to inequality, was some kind of compromise between giving people equality of opportunity and worrying about equality of outcome. Because if you give people pure equality, I know this is way off the subject, but yeah, if you give people pure equality of opportunity, right, then people who have more capability, whether it's, you know, stick-to-itiveness, ability to resist temptation, IQ, whatever it is, are going to, then there's nothing to even the game up, right? So then what do? Do you then, and so, and we, you know, worked through this with these Singaporean kids and a guy from India and my co-teacher and I, and, you know, the answer at the end was you try to come to some kind of balance, accommodation, some way of doing something that seems to be fair to the most people. That would be how you deal with people who have greater means than others in this area as in other areas of life, some kind of accommodation of that fact without making them feel so screwed that they say, you know, no government program at all. Or when I was driving yesterday, there was a guy in front of me with a license plate. The rear license plate didn't have numbers. It said John Galt. For those of you who don't know, the hero of Ayn Rand's, one of her libertarian novels.
I'm glad you shifted over and talked about teaching, because after being a journalist for 30 years, you're reaching millions of people. Your reports teach. Mm-hmm. Don't just report, they
That's
teach.
That's what I've always tried to do, yes.
Well, you've nailed it.
But
you've talked to millions. Why are you back in the classroom now? Why are you talking to dozens?
That's a good question. because lifelong learning, it seems to me, is so absolutely critical, particularly in a world that's moving as fast as ours is. And partly because you forget stuff, so you want to reread stuff you read before. I used to say to people, "Oh no, I read that," and then it occurred to me, but I don't remember any of it. So the hell difference does it make? I read Turgenev's Fathers and Sons twice. I still don't remember anything of that. I know I read it twice. I swear to God, but I read it a long time ago. To be an inquiring person and to have the responsibility and the privilege, I'm not, you know, lying about this making it more than it is, but to have the privilege of having audiences like you and I do, I mean, really, you know, it's just an unbelievable privilege and a responsibility. And we all think we're faking it anyway. I'm sure that's true of all of you as well. You know, but and every professor, by the way, if you get down to it, you know, I say, because I introduce myself as an imposter, and they all go, don't worry, we're imposters too. We're all imposters here. But you don't want to be that much of an imposter. You know, you want to actually know some stuff. You want to know more than the people in the room. And you want to be intellectually alive so that you don't forget things and that you're, you know, open to new ideas so that you're not stuck, you know, peddling some line from 1977 that I learned at Harvard Business School. And, you know, Japan is number one. You know, it would be a big mistake if I kept going, no, Japan is number one, seriously. I read that book, and I remember what it said. Japan is number one. So that's one reason. The other reason is, and it's related, is that when, even if it's only 12, if you're at my age, so I'll be 71 in September, and to have that kind of connection with young people, hear what they're thinking, connect with them, makes you feel like you're part of the world. You know, one of the things that's weird about TV is, you know, it's a million people or whatever it is, and another hundreds of thousands on radio, particularly out here because it comes out on early. But you don't see any of them, you know. It's just out into the void, you know. They come up to you and say, oh, I know you from television, you know. But with an audience where, you know, it's like this. I mean, this guy over here is laughing his head off. And it's just a tremendous charge. I'm connecting, you know, at least with you. Or, you know, there are a number of people here when it's already, and we're not talking. But if it's, you know, a seminar and I'm just letting you talk. So what do you think? You know, what do you think? That's just tremendously invigorating. That's all.
Who understands the effects of the economy more? The academics you were just talking about, journalists, people on the street? Who gets it?
No.
Okay, those who are thinking
off,
about it.
I live off of the people on the street.
Who gets it?
It's more individuals who get it rather than a class of people, I think. You know, academics, economists is the term you used. Economists, they have what economists would call perverse incentives. This guy gets all my jokes. Just come up here and just... I'll just talk to you. You all listen in. No. What I mean is, the way the social so-called sciences, okay, you know, psychology, anthropology, sociology, economics, have always been kind of second fiddle to the sciences, and you know, and the university level. I mean, not that fewer people take the courses, but in terms of status hierarchy, what I'm about to say is actually true, although it sounds like a gag. The best economists and even the best economists are essentially failed physicists, who are essentially failed mathematicians. Now, that's a wild, you know, gross overgeneralization, but there is real truth to that. You know, you're really good at math, but you're not really, really, really good. Right? But you're good at math. So then you go, okay, I'm good at math, so I'll teach math. And the economics courses, until you get to actual life, are applied math courses, the first economics courses you take in school, and later on, and you get your PhD by coming up with some mathematical representation of something that happens in the world supposedly if all the assumptions were true, and none of them are. None of them. We are not rational maximizers. That's about 50% of the variance. The other part is we love each other. We do stuff for each other. We're not rationally maximizing at all. In fact, we give stuff to other people. What kind of... So, and that's just for openers. Then it's, is there a symmetry? I could go on and on about this, but is there a symmetry between buyers and sellers? No, of course not. There's no symmetry. The guy won Nobel Prize for saying, no, there's no symmetry between.
And with that, our thanks to Paul Tallman. Business and economics correspondent. PBS NewsHour and co-author of the new book, Get What's Yours, The Secret to Maxing Out Your Social Security. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Michael Finney from KGO Television in San Francisco and radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.